You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 260, Exodus 3, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, how you doing, sir?
Pretty good. We actually had some snow in our neck of the woods, Trey, but I'm glad it's melting.
Oh, really? It's a hot 65 degrees here, so I don't know what you speak of.
We got 6 to 8 inches. It was just every once in a while we get these freak snows, so we got another one, but I'm glad to see it go.
Yeah, I bet. Well, Mike, we're on 260, so we're just a little over halfway to 500. That's pretty
That's
impressive.
One way to look at it. Yes. Yeah, it's kind of an impressive. Unimaginable number at this point, but I guess 260 would have been unimaginable a while back. So,
yeah, just a reminder that I think 300 falls during the convention this year, SBL, wow. And ETS in San Diego. So we're definitely going to have to do something, our live event for that. So be on the lookout and listening to the details for whatever we come up with to celebrate a 300 and do our live one there.
Yes. San Diego ought to be at least the weather will be good.
Yeah. You would think. Go. No snow.
Yeah. No snow. So that's a thumbs up to that.
Well, Mike,
After 12 years in the Midwest, you know, I've had enough snow, really. I've had enough. So,
yeah. Well, we were talking before the show, but we're going to split chapter 3 into three parts. I love this. So this is part one of three parts. What's that about?
Yeah, I was just kind of pulling my hair out. So believe it or not, we're going to spend 2 episodes on the first verse of Exodus 3.
I love it.
You know, it's just like I can't get away from it. So the way it's going to break down is this episode is going to be about Midian and Sinai, and also Yahweh's southern origin, which might be new to some listeners. And then next time we're going to be, part two will be on the Kenite hypothesis, which again might be new to a number of listeners, but I'm going to telegraph it this way. On the surface, the Kenite hypothesis is about Moses' lineage. And part of that is, you know, concerns Edom and Esau's line. We've already made comments about that on an earlier episode. And, you know, sort of the, you know, where the other half of Abraham's family wound up, the descendants of Esau, and how that factors into Israelite history at this point. Having said that, the Kenite hypothesis is ultimately related back in scholarship to Cain. Okay, Genesis 4. And believe it or not, there is a Watcher's connection here. I have not written anything on Cain and Genesis 4. But again, it might sound goofy, but believe it or not, you're going to get that in part 2. We're going to be in the book of Exodus talking about Exodus 3, and somehow we're going to wind up talking about the Watcher story as well. And then part 3 is going to be the revelation of the divine name, which is what everybody sort of associates with Exodus 3, where at the burning bush incident. So there you go. I just had to keep them separate. There's too much detail for all of that in one episode. So here we are.
Oh, I'm looking for part 2. Anytime you can connect the Watchers to anything, I'm all about it.
Yeah, I know people are going to hear that and go, what in the world? I mean, I thought Heiser had 2 heads. Now he's got 3. No, I'm going to be building off. I'll give this much of a clue as well. I'm going to be building off the work of another scholar, Philip Essler, who's done a lot of work on the Watcher traditions. And he's a lesser known scholar, but has some really important material on the Watcher traditions. And he goes into Cain a lot. And once you get into the Kenite stuff, you got to go back to Cain because that's just part of the discussion. And so we're going to have to get into the woods there. You know, it sounds odd, but hey, you know, you just follow the threads and I'm not making anything up. It's the same thing we always do. We just talk about the work of biblical scholars on all sorts of things. And yep, you know, some of them see some pretty interesting connections here.
Well, we love the weeds.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of that here, you know. even more so than I imagined. I had a what was I thinking moment a few days ago, trying to unravel this. Like, why did I suggest Exodus? What happened to me? You know, I can usually see, you know, where something's going to just devolve into too much work, and I must have just blanked out.
But well, this is your wheelhouse. This is exactly what we expected. Three parts on chapter three there alone. I mean, that's exactly, we've got two parts in chapter two.
Yeah.
Or was that chapter one?
Well, I mean, not every chapter is going to be like this. But Exodus 3 just sort of lends itself to it. Well, we might as well jump in. I mean, this is, again, going to be a bit gnarly. There's an element of difficulty here, and I have a makeshift map that I'm going to have Trey upload to the episode site. It's actually best if you're looking at the map, or you get the map fixed in your head while you listen to this episode, because we're going to be dealing with some geographical stuff. So there's a visual component here again, and visual stuff doesn't normally translate well to audio podcasts, but again, we're just going to make a good faith effort and put a map up there so that you can reference it. But we're going to get into some things that it's just essential, unless you sort of have a really good sort of orientation to the geography of Canaan and the Transjordan, and of course the Sinai Peninsula and the Arabian Peninsula. If you know that already, well, then you're good. But most listeners will not, and they'll need to look at a map. So let's, for the sake of the episode, just rehearse Exodus 3:1, if it's not already fixed in our minds, because we've traversed through here a bit before. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now some preliminaries here. We've already brought up, and now we're going to drill down into the relationship between Sinai and Horeb. The mountain here is called Horeb in Exodus 3:1. Elsewhere, it's called Sinai. Most of the time, it's called Sinai. And also the relationship between Sinai and Horeb and Midian, okay, the place known as Midian. Secondly, we are going to need to deal with the relationship of all that, Sinai, Horeb, and Midian, with quote-unquote, Yahweh's march from the south traditions in the Hebrew Bible. Now, this is going to be unfamiliar to a number of listeners, but it's just sort of, you know, it's all over the place. I mean, you can't discuss Exodus 3 and really Exodus 6 without getting into this material. So this is why we're doing it specifically, and we'll look at all these passages that are relevant. Yahweh is said in the Hebrew Bible in a number of places to have come to his land or come to his temple from the south. And the passages explicitly define the south with geographical terms like Paran, Teman, Seir, and Edom. Okay, so if you're thinking already, well, the south, that would be the Mount Sinai, the Sinai Peninsula, the traditional site of Sinai. Or if you're thinking, oh, well, you know, Jebel el-Laws, you know, in Midian, you know, I think that's Mount Sinai, and that's south of Canaan. So that's what those passages are talking about. Sorry, they're not. Again, they use specific geographical terms, Paran, Teman, Seir, and Edom. So either the association with Midian in Exodus 3:1, and at least another passage, for Yahweh's abode is reconcilable with those other places, or we have contradicting traditions. So there's real issue here. These other places are a good bit to the north, again, of where people typically want Sinai to be, either the traditional location, way to way, way down the Sinai Peninsula, at the V of the two forks of the Red Sea, right in there. Or again, this idea comes and goes, but the idea that Sinai is in Saudi Arabia at Jebel al-Laws, which is to the east, you know, about, I don't know, midway, maybe a two-thirds of the way up the fork, the right-hand fork of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba. Again, those other places are a good bit north, they're a good bit south to Edom, Teman, Paran, and Seir. So we have to figure out either a way to reconcile some of this stuff, or we've got contradictions. Now, I'm going to suggest that there's a way to understand all of the data collectively, but the way that I'm going to suggest undermines both the traditional view of Sinai and the Jebel al-Law's location of Sinai. Both of them, I think, go out the window if you are going to try to reconcile holy mountain, you know, Sinai Horeb stuff with Yahweh coming from the south. Both of those locations are too far south of Timon, Paran, Seir, and Edom. They just are. It just doesn't work. So this is another reason why I said, if you think, and if you come across people, I know for sure where Mount Sinai is. If they are not dealing with the passages we're going to deal with today that have Yahweh coming from these regions that are much farther north, but of course still south of Canaan, if they're not dealing with these passages, you can politely dismiss them because they have not dealt with important data. So I'm hoping that, again, that being the case is going to be clear here. Now, you might ask, well, why bother, you know, with all this? I mean, again, we're into the weeds here. And for me, there's three reasons. I think we do need to be faithful to the details of the text and offer a coherent resolution to what seems on the surface contradictory. At least some think it's contradictory. And I'll add that if we do that, the resolution that I'm going to offer here will also be helpful in the next episode, next week, with the Kenite hypothesis, that whole issue. Second, I would say I'm hoping that this will convince listeners to not get sidetracked on rabbit trails like the idea that Mount Sinai is in Arabia or that determining the location of Mount Sinai has any theological importance. It really doesn't. I think those are distractions that can grow into dogma as though something crucial has been discovered. There's nothing crucial here in the way of theology or eschatology or anything like that. The reality is that it's pretty unlikely that either the traditional location of Mount Sinai, again, deep in the Sinai Peninsula in the V of the two prongs of the Red Sea, otherwise known as Jebel Musa, or the alleged Mount Sinai in Arabia, Jebel al-Laws, it's really unlikely that those are the real locations of Sinai. Again, if you care, and I do, and I'm not the only one, if you care about reconciling the mountain of God idea, again, Horeb Sinai, with the tradition of Yahweh coming from the south, then both of those locations are just not going to work. And I do care. I think it's important that all of the data be reconciled. And again, that issue itself might be new to listeners, but again, it's in your Bible. You know, I don't write the stuff. This is just the reality of the text. You know, we have to deal with it. And third, I think the point needs to be made that, again, the Yahweh from the south traditions can't be ignored, that they not only need to be aligned with Exodus 3, but this is also an issue for what we're going to run into in Exodus 6:3. Let me just read you that verse, where God says to Moses, "I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, El Shaddai, but by my name Yahweh, I did not make myself known to them." Okay, that is actually wrapped up in the Yahweh from the south traditions. And here you have Moses, you know, in a conversation with God, and you have that statement made. You know, critics have acted like the revelation of the divine name in Exodus 3 and that statement in Exodus 6:3 justify some sort of notion that there are separate, and this is a key word, utterly distinct origins for Yahweh worship. They act the same way with respect to Yahweh traditions from the south, Edom, Seir, Timon, Paran, and the descendants of Jacob in Egypt. The Bible presents us, I think, with a coherent picture, not one that should shock us into thinking Yahweh religion, again, another key term, originated somewhere other than with the Israelites in Egypt. The Bible's picture is that the deity is the same, but the names are different. And that the name revealed to Moses was already in use by an Abrahamic people, i.e. the descendants of Esau, doesn't undermine anything in biblical theology. I mean, that would be expected. The Old Testament picture is that Abraham's descendants went separate ways. The line of Jacob went one way, the line of Esau went another, you know, because of the whole birthright issue. Now, it's quite logical that both lines knew the God of their father Isaac and their grandfather Abraham and continued to worship him. The real issues are how Yahweh name use is known in Edomite or Esau territory, but seems to be new in terms of Moses in Exodus 3 and in Exodus 6:3. Now, we'll get into that more in more detail in later episodes. We'll touch on it here. A short version, it's not impossible that the name Yahweh was known by Semites in Egypt long before Moses, who took it to the Edomite regions. I mean, there is a textual argument to be made, specifically in Egyptian texts, that the name Yahweh was known among Semites in the Sinai region, like in mines, you know, mining contexts and whatnot. And, you know, it's conceivable that some Semites knew the name Yahweh there and took it up north into Edom, Seir, Paran area. I mean, that's not impossible. I mean, the name does show up, you know, in Egyptian material associated with, you know, this region. So, you know, Exodus 3 doesn't undermine that. You might say, well, Exodus 3 might undermine it. It sounds like Moses didn't know the name. Well, let's not forget where Moses was raised. He was raised in Pharaoh's household right after being weaned. Yes, he knew who he was ethnically. He knew he was a Hebrew. But it's quite possible he didn't know the name Yahweh. Why would Pharaoh's household, why would the people there be teaching him about that? He's not trained by his mother. His mother has him until he's weaned, and then he is in Pharaoh's household. It's quite conceivable. Again, while he knows what his ethnicity is, that he has not heard the name of Yahweh. That's possible. Again, his break with Egypt, if you read the Moses story, is about injustice toward his people. He didn't like the fact that they were enslaved. It's not about religion. Moses doesn't break from Pharaoh's household because of religion. Okay, he's upset at what is happening to his ethnic kindred. And then he gets into trouble by murdering a man, and he escapes to Midian, where again, providentially, he runs into descendants of his forefather Abraham, who do happen to know the God of their fathers by the name Yahweh, historically, and then the name is revealed by God himself to Moses. You can take all this data, and you don't have to talk about, oh, well, this source used this name, and this source used that name, and you know, the dirty little secret of Yahweh religion is that, you know, the people, the descendants of Jacob and Esau, they never heard of Yahweh, and you know, this is a different God than what we see in the South in Edom and Paran, and they knew the name Yahweh, or religion has its origin somewhere else, and the Bible is trying to cover this up, or, you know, look. This is a quite understandable picture. It's just, this is the kind of thing that source critics love to, what's the right word? They love to grab it and then leverage it in all sorts of ways. It's quite unnecessary. And you know, if you listen to this podcast, I'm not an opponent of editing in the Torah. Okay, how many times do I have to say this? I'm not an opponent of that. But typically what happens is source critical theory exaggerates and overstates data. And I think this is a good example of it. Again, it is quite conceivable that Moses had not heard this name, but he had heard of the God of his fathers at some point. You know, I mean, he knew who the Hebrews were. Again, the name could have been, you know, circulating in Egypt, you know, at least among, you know, the slaves working the mines in Sinai. Again, you do see this with certain, at least one people group that are associated with the Negev and with, you know, the up even upward north, you know, to the regions we're talking about here, Edom and Paran and Timon. You know, again, they're still part of the line of Abraham, and you know they have this name, and maybe Moses doesn't. Now I say all of that to say this. Exodus 6:3, which generates a lot of this discussion that Moses didn't know the name, may actually not be translated the way it should be. I've commented on this on my blog, that Exodus 6:3, if you follow the work of Francis Anderson, specifically in his book, The Sentence in Biblical Hebrew, translates this quite different, where you don't have Moses not knowing the name. you have the opposite. And that's a little factoid that is almost never mentioned in the discussions of Exodus 6:3. Almost never. It's really rare. But Francis Anderson, again, I think he's still alive. This is the Anderson of Anderson Forbes, the database that we developed where I work at Logos. Francis Anderson is a premier Hebraist. That's probably a humble way to describe him. There are few who know their Hebrew as well as Francis Anderson. And so his work in this verse ought to be taken seriously, but it's rarely even mentioned. Because again, people, writers, scholars want to leverage an idea, source criticism, alternate hypothesis for Israelite religion, you know, whatever the case may be. That's just the way it is. So all of this is preliminary. I mean, we're going to get into the weeds again here in Exodus 3, but I'm telegraphing some of the things that we're going to run into, and some of what we'll do in this episode will actually, again, factor into some of that discussion. But for the sake of our episode at this point, I think it's really important that the Yahweh of the South traditions be reconciled, be understood alongside of passages like Exodus 3 and the Horeb and the Sinai traditions. I think they need to be understood together, and they can be. But if you do that, you really can't have Mount Sinai being in the southern Sinai Peninsula at the traditional location. And the Jebel El-Law's location doesn't really work well either. That one, you know, it's not impossible for it to work. I would say it's really, really, really unlikely. And that means that you'd have to come up with some other mountain. And there have been lots of proposals for Mount Sinai. It's not just those two. And my gut would tell me that if you're going to take the Yahweh from the South tradition seriously, one of those other possibilities might be the right one. So let's just jump in here. To refresh your memory, again, Exodus 3:1, now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And as I mentioned in a previous episode, the verse is typically read as though Moses is tending his father-in-law's flocks in Midian. And so the mountain of God seems to be in Midian. If you're doing the Jebel El-Laws thing, that's the way you have to read this, that Sinai is in Midian. But the verse may also not be read that way. Again, the verse could be very obviously saying that Moses left Midian and journeyed a little ways to the west. We actually do not know where in Midian Moses was. And that's a problem. I mean, Midian's a pretty big area. We don't know exactly where he was. And if we're going to read it as Moses goes somewhere else and then comes to the mountain of God, well, that opens the door to other possibilities. You have to decide to read Exodus 3:1 in a specific way to have Moses tending his flocks in Midian at Mount Sinai. And this is what the movie does, the Ten Commandments movie. If you remember the Ten Commandments movie, it's like Mount Sinai is like, you know, a couple hundred yards, you know, from where, you know, Moses is and where, you know, he and Zipporah are living. You know, there's nothing in the text that tells you that. Nothing at all. So all we've got is Moses is somewhere in Midian. The text is clear that he leads the flocks, quote, to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb. He has to go, so he has to make a journey to get to the mountain of God. That's what it says. It doesn't say that he was already at the mountain of God, like the Ten Commandments movie has it. Like the verse doesn't suggest that Moses had to lead the flocks of Jethro a few hundred yards. No, I think it's much more coherent to say Moses had to take him somewhere else. And that somewhere else, to the west of Midian, is where we find this mountain of God. That's where Moses' encounter with Yahweh occurs. Now, that's important to keep in mind, that Moses has to essentially leave Midian, or at least leave the part of Midian where he was, which again, we don't actually know precisely where that was, you know, where Jethro lived. Okay, we don't know where that is. We just know it's in Midian. It's a big area. But the fact that he has to leave and he winds up going west, well, again, we know he's not at Jebel El-Laws, because if he went west, he'd run into the Gulf of Aqaba, the ocean. Okay. It's not a wilderness where you're going to, you know, have herds. Okay. So that's an absurdity. So he's going to have to go beyond the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba somewhere. He's going to have to go north and northwest. You know, the west would be, you got to clear the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, the right prong of the Red Sea. And now you can find some area where, you know, you can take your flocks. Okay. So that much we know. Well, if you go far enough north, you're in Paran, Timon, Seir, Edom area. I mean, there's a place where Midian blurs into Edomite territory to the north. And if it's northwest, it's also going to blur into Canaanite, you know, Canaan territory. Again, we just don't know where. Nobody's out there with surveyor's poles and marking land, okay? But these three regions, Midian, Edom, again, Seir, and the Paran Timon area, there's going to be a place where they're basically kind of on top of each other, one to the north, one to the northwest, okay? And so you can imagine very easily that Moses would have taken the flocks northward, you know, from some point in Midian. And frankly, since we know that Moses wasn't like living at Jebel El-Laws, okay, that's not where he was, because if he goes west, he's going to run into salt, you know, he's going to run into the Red Sea, okay? So he's probably somewhere already north in Midian, and then he would have migrated west, just like Exodus 3:1 says. He took the flocks to the west, okay? The edge of the side of the wilderness, okay? West side of the wilderness, you know, so he's already going to be up there, and the move west again could take him into where these other areas converge. Again, we have to use our imagination here because we aren't given latitude and longitude in Exodus 3 or anywhere else. We're given approximations. But again, my concern is that we take the material of Exodus 3 and passages like it, and then the Yahweh from the South traditions. We need to understand them collectively. That's important, you know, for consistency. Now let's refresh our memory a little bit as to, you know, what, you know, Midian was. So, you know, Moses is somewhere in Midian. Again, the place of encounter is associated with Paran, Timon, Seir, and Edom. So we have, I think I read this last time or previous episode from Sarna in his Exodus commentary. The Midianites ranged over a wide area of the Near East, stretching from the eastern shore of the Gulf of Aqaba up through the Syro-Arabian Desert and into the borders of the land of Israel, west and northwest of Eilat. Now, Eilat is right at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, the right prong of the Red Sea. And so Midian is sort of all of that. And again, that helps orient us. If you need the map, you know, please look at it. Now, how would we start to kind of pull all this stuff together? You don't know what the Yahweh from the South passages are because I haven't read them. I'm going to do that now. But just be thinking about Midian. Thinking about the map or looking at the map, you've got the Red Sea, the two prongs. The right-hand prong is the Gulf of Aqaba. The tip of that is Eilat. Midian is going to be to the east of that and also, again, to the north of that, the west and the northwest of Eilat. So right when you clear the tip, again, Moses is somewhere in there. Midian's going to encompass a good part of what we call today the Arabian Peninsula, where Saudi Arabia is. And he's going to be somewhere in there, and he's going to move to the west, you know, to the west of the wilderness, all right? So he's moving, you know, either west or northwest, okay? We don't know. We don't have latitude and longitude. But that's going to move him into the areas where Midian touches, you know, overlaps with, you know, the borders are fuzzy with these southern places, Paran, Timon, Seir, Edom. Now, let me read you a few passages. Deuteronomy 33:1 says, "This is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the people of Israel before his death. He said, the Lord, Yahweh, it's the divine name, came from Sinai and dawned from Seir, S-E-I-R, upon us." Let me repeat that. The Lord came from Sinai and dawned from Seir upon us. He shone forth from Mount Paran. Oh boy. not only do you have Sinai linked to Seir, which is, again, this Edomite region south of Canaan, but we have Mount Paran as the place that Yahweh came forth from. Well, I thought it was Sinai. Oh, I thought it was Horeb. Well, the answer very well may be, yep, all of those terms could apply to the same place. They could. Now, critics, of course, want to split them all out, you know, as though they must be different places. They don't have to be different places. I mean, in theory, they could be, you know, then you'd have different conflicting traditions. So again, this is where they want you to go. But they don't have to be, is the point. They don't have to be. Again, Mount Paran, if you read this verse, would be the same as, you know, Mount Sinai, which would be Horeb. So, but where is that? Well, I don't know. Neither does anybody else, is the point. Again, you can't reconcile the traditional location of Sinai with Deuteronomy 33, 1 and 2. Because the passage reads, again, pretty transparently, that Sinai is associated with Seir and Mount Paran. These regions are south of Canaan. So these are part of a matrix of passages, matrix of ideas, really, in biblical scholarship that scholars call the Yahweh from the south traditions. Okay. And Midian, sorry, but Jebel El-Laws is not in Seir and it's not in Paran. It just isn't. Let's go to Habakkuk 3. God came from Teman. This is verse 3, Habakkuk 3, 3. I'm going to read 3 through 7. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. There it is again, just like it was in Deuteronomy 33, verse 2. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand. By the way, that language, some of that is reminiscent of Deuteronomy 33. Okay. There he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. Here's verse 7. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. So now this brings Midian into the picture, also with Teman and Paran. And there's only one way you can do that, again, to have this, whatever's happening here, and whatever peak this is, that it's in some area that it could be perceived as Midian and Seir, and we're going to get Edom. Again, these places converge or overlap. And again, when I say that, you can't be thinking of like maps of countries today where there are strictly defined borders. You just don't have that. Again, these are regions that don't have that level of precision as to their border lines. There's a fuzziness to all this. Okay. Again, the passage, Habakkuk 3, associates Mount Paran, which Deuteronomy 33, 1 and 2 link to Sinai and Seir. It links Paran to Midian. So Teman, Paran, and Seir and Midian are somehow interrelated. Now, this is possible, again, if by Midian we mean that northernmost, northwesternmost parameters, where it borders Edom to the north and southern Canaan to the west. And by the way, I would think that if you took that, if you thought about that, and then you read Exodus 3:1, where you have Moses taking his flock to the west side of the wilderness, you can reconcile those things. Again, especially since we don't know where Moses' starting point was. He could have been due east of where all this is happening, and then he moves straight west. We don't know. We just know from these descriptions, the Yahweh from the south traditions, which again link Midian into this, you know, some portion, some part perceptively of Midian, with these southern regions, Edom, Seir, Paran, Teman. Judges 5 is another one of these, 4 and 5. Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the region of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens dropped. See, there you get apocalyptic, you know, this cataclysmic language that we just read from Habakkuk 3, where God was coming from Teman and Mount Paran. But now we get Seir and Edom, the earth trembled, the heavens dropped, the clouds dropped water, the mountains quaked before the Lord, even Sinai before the Lord, the God of Israel. That's Judges 5, 4, and 5. Now, this passage juxtaposes Seir and Edom and once again makes Sinai part of the picture. Verse 4's association of Seir and Edom, of course, makes sense because Seir, according to the Archaeological Encyclopedia of the Holy Land, was the name of a mountainous region southeast of the Dead Sea. Again, if you're looking at the map, you're going to see that. It was formerly inhabited by Horites, Genesis 14, 6. And boy, isn't that interesting. And we can't really get into the people groups here or in the next few weeks either. Formerly inhabited by the Horites where Esau lived later. Esau lived later. Okay, I can't resist it. Go back and read Deuteronomy 2 and 3. Okay, get that spasm out of the way. Where Esau lived later. Again, this area identified with Edom in Genesis 36, 8 and following. So how are we to deal with the data? And we got three passages here. I would say, you know, just in basic terms, there's no way to get the traditional site of Sinai near Edom. So I am not a believer in the traditional site, Jebel Musa, for being Mount Sinai. I also don't think there's a way to get Jebel El-Laws into Edom or near Edom, because it isn't. It's farther down, you know, adjacent to the Gulf of Aqaba, you know, in sort of, you know, in that portion of Midian. It's just not, it's not in Edom. It's not near Paran or Taman. So my suggestion is, let's stop trying to defend either of these views. Here's a proposal. Again, it's sort of like a working hypothesis, and then we'll get into some of the nuts and bolts of it here. I would say that maybe this is what happened. Again, this is a working hypothesis. It's a working process as well. Moses leaves Midian proper, which is east. And again, we don't know where he is, possibly even already north of the Gulf of Aqaba, northeast of the Gulf of Aqaba. He's somewhere in Midian up there. He takes Jethro's flocks westward or northwestward. He's going to be clear the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba where Eilat is located. And he's moving again westward or northwestward, at least slightly, you know, to honor Exodus 3:1, the language there. He winds up somewhere in the vicinity of the northwest fringe of northern Midian, where Midian borders the southern border of Canaan, and where it also blurs into the land of Edom. Again, look at the map. It is somewhere in this location, somewhere in this region, where all these things are possible, all these things are in play, that Moses encounters Yahweh on a mountain, variously called Sinai or Horeb. We saw last time that Horeb, again in a previous episode, Horeb may simply refer to a dry area. That's what it means. May simply refer to a dry area that included a mountainous region. As Sarna said, Horeb may have been the name of a wider region in which Mount Sinai, a specific peak, was located. Again, and then that Horeb could be in this, you know, this geographical region we're talking about. You know, Edom, Seir, all that. Because Seir, again, is a mountainous region, as we just read. You know, there's going to be some peak there that eventually lent its name to the entire area, perhaps. Horeb, again, means desolate or dry, but maybe Horeb becomes later associated as a term with the specific mountain in this region that could be spoken of as being somewhere, you know, still associated with Midian up north, associated with Edom and Seir and Paran and Timon, that area, okay? Somewhere in that area. All this stuff happens. I'm going to take you back to Sarna a little bit again here. We've already mentioned that Horeb means desolate and dry. We read earlier Exodus 17, 1 through 7, and this is the incident at Rephidim. So we read that, read it again, we'll just start from verse 1. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. There was no water for the people to drink. So then they cry out for water, so on and so forth, and then Moses cries to the Lord in verse 4, what am I supposed to do with these people? They're ready to stone me. And then God says in verse 5, the Lord said to Moses, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile. And go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. Now, again, this Horeb reference here, Sarna pointed out then if you look at the Israelite itinerary, you know, their journeyings, Rephidim was the last station of the Israelites before entering the wilderness of Sinai. So this place where they're at, Rephidim, which has this rock at Horeb, is not Sinai. It's the last station of the Israelites before entering the wilderness of Sinai. And then Sarna says, we may be dealing with different strands of tradition, or Horeb may have been the name of a wider region in which Mount Sinai, a specific peak, was located. Perhaps that peak eventually lent its name to the entire area. So, you know, this, none of that, again, the separation of Horeb from Sinai, that doesn't undermine, again, what I'm proposing about all of these terms being interrelated, because, again, the region itself might be what Horeb is referencing. And again, if it is associated with Seir and Timon and Paran, Seir, again, is a mountainous region. You could have one specific peak somewhere, you know, in that geographical zone that we really can't define, but somewhere south of Canaan, because Yahweh comes from the south, somewhere that's still adjacent to Midian, so we can talk about Midian. And again, it's going to be north, possibly northwest of the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. Okay, you somewhere up there. You know, if you factor this in, we can, the hypothesis is still workable, that there's a, you know, distinction between the mountain, you know, Sinai proper and Horeb. Okay, good, fine. Dry place that later becomes known by a single, you know, who knows? Ultimately, you know, who knows? What I'm trying to get you to see is that these disparate data points are not irreconcilable. There is a way that they can be imagined as functioning together and inclusive of the Yahweh from the south traditions. Now let's go back to Exodus 3:1 real briefly. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now the way ESV has that translated, it suggests that the mountain of God was called Horeb. But the Hebrew text actually doesn't require that and might even contradict it. So again, we don't have to have Horeb even be specifically in this verse associated with, you know, a singular peak. So this whole regional idea, and then by tradition, you know, one part of one mountain in this region becomes identified. I mean, that's workable. But I just want to point out here in this particular verse, that ESV might be a little misleading, you know, unintentionally. Here, the Hebrew has El Har Ha Elohim Korba. Literally, it's he takes the flocks to the mountain of God, to Horeb. What we have here on the proper name for Horeb, this Chet Resh Bet, we have a He on the end. It's called a locative He. It denotes location. In Hebrew, sometimes the letter He, the H, is added to a noun to denote a, you know, going to that place. It's called the locative hay. So Horeb might merely denote a dry place that Moses goes to. You know, he went to the mountain of God to Horeb. So in other words, the mountain of God is in Horeb, but the mountain of God isn't necessarily named Horeb. Could very well be the understanding of Exodus 3:1, but the ESV doesn't give you that impression, and other translations as well. Again, consequently, why am I bringing it up? Because it's another factor here that if Moses left Midian and traveled to the mountain of God in or at this region, this place called Horeb, which was in a wilderness area or at least adjacent to one, that doesn't seem incompatible at all with Exodus 17:1 through 7, where Horeb, dry area, and Sinai, the mountain, are not synonymous either. See, they don't have to be synonymous in Exodus 3:1, and they don't have to be synonymous in Exodus 17. Again, these things are compatible, is the point. Now, there are other data that can be factored into this as well. And in the next two episodes, you know, we'll hit more of that, especially when we hit the Kenite issue and the revelation of the divine name. But I want to, you know, we're going to, again, say more about what I'm going to jump into now in those episodes, but I want to sort of get into it a little bit here. And that is with respect to Yahweh traditions, the name Yahweh in other places. Now, I'm going to read from DDD. This is the entry on Yahweh, where the author is Van der Torn, says, there are two Egyptian texts that mention Yahweh. In these texts from the 14th and 13th centuries BCE is what he uses. And by the way, that, again, the 13th century would be the late date century. This is still, these two texts are going to still be too late for the early date of the Exodus. There are two Egyptian texts that mention Yahweh that date from the 14th and 13th centuries BCE. Yahweh is neither connected with the Israelites, again, in these texts, nor is his cult located in Palestine, i.e. Canaan. The texts speak about, quote, Yahu in the land of the Shasu Bedouins, unquote. The Egyptian is Ta Shasu Yahuwah. So the one text is from the reign of Amenophis III, which is the first part of the 14th century BC, and the other one is from the reign of Ramses II, 13th century BCE. Again, that's the late date pharaoh, late date option anyway. In the Ramses II list, the name occurs in a context which also mentions, believe it or not, seer. Oh, boy. It may tentatively be concluded then that this Yahu in the land of the Shasu Bedouins is to be situated in the area of Edom and Midian. Of course, the northern northwest edge of Midian. So you actually have a reference to Yahu in Egyptian material, in Seir, in Edom. Again, there you go. You know, this isn't like explosive. This is in concert with the picture, again, my working hypothesis that I just, you know, sort of, you know, laid out. So another quote about this material. This is from Mark Chevalis. This is from the Dictionary of the Old Testament Pentateuch in the Moses entry. He says, Yahu, YHW, is also the name of a Shasu country in connection with Midian and Seir. These occur, again, these references occur in an Egyptian eponym list from the time of Amenhotep III, circa 1400 BC, and in a text dated to Ramses II, a century later. Some have seen them as consistent with the poetic language in the Bible associating Yahweh with the region of Sinai, Seir, Edom, Paran, Timon, and Midian. And then he references Deuteronomy 33:2, Judges 5:4, and Psalm 68. We didn't read that one. Some have argued that the biblical Kenites, a branch of the Midianites, were the mediators of the Yahwistic cult, possibly by way of traders along the caravan routes from the south to the east. That's the end of the quote. Again, just another scholar, not only pointing out the Egyptian material, the reference to the name Yahweh in Midian and Seir, but also bringing the Yahweh from the south traditions into the picture. Again, this writer, Chevalis, is well acquainted with the fact that the Yahweh from the south traditions are part of this whole issue that we're talking about. Again, the mountain of God traditions and the divine name and all that sort of stuff. Now, there's more recent research on this, and I put this in the protected folder for those who are newsletter subscribers. This is a dissertation. It's available online, but I put it in the folder anyway. This is by Julianne Cooper, who is a man. Now, you might be thinking Julian would be a woman's name, but Julianne with an E, Cooper, who's at Yale now. But this was his PhD dissertation from the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie, I think I'm saying that correctly, University in Australia. And its title is Toponymy, a toponym, by the way, is a place name. Toponymy on the Periphery, Place Names of the Eastern Desert, Red Sea, and South Sinai in Egyptian Documents from the Early Dynastic until the End of the New Kingdom. That's his dissertation. Now, he says on page 185 that the place name, the Yahweh of the Shasu Bedouin, he says, whether this place name can be used as evidence for an early cult, the early worship of Yahweh, seems far from certain. And that's being honest. The name is at least used among a people, again, who are in the region of Seir, who by biblical standards would have descended from Esau. Again, they're still descendants of Abraham. But he's saying, you know, it's just a place name. We don't know that it's evidence that Yahweh was actually worshipped there. Okay, that could be. I mean, we don't want to overstate the data. It's just an interesting observation. But I wanted to bring Cooper into the conversation for a different reason. You know, while we're on the subject of etymology, what about the name Sinai? So Cooper, in his dissertation, discusses this name as well. on page 214. The other one was on page, I don't know if I gave it 186, 185, 186. On page 214, Cooper writes this: the etymology of Sinai is usually explained through biblical Hebrew sena, the bush. Sena, sena is a name for bush, a word for bush. And it actually shows up in Exodus 3, verses 2 and 4. So again, he's saying this is the way Sinai is usually explained as being a name derived from the place, you know, this the burning bush incident, you know, where these bushes are, you know, and Moses has this encounter. However, he says, there's no consensus amongst biblical historians as to the etymology of Sinai. Connections to Semitic SN, tooth, Arabic Sina, stone, and Sin, the Mesopotamian moon god and the territorial entity of Sin, have also been proposed as equally valid as Sena, bush. So again, unpacking that paragraph, that's the end of the quote. What that means is that scholars have tried to figure out, you know, where Sinai comes from, the term. The easiest and basically the most obvious is this, well, it comes from the passage, the bush there, Sena. But other, you know, others have tried to find a derivation from Arabic and Proto-Semitic, and then some want to say, well, no, it comes from the Mesopotamian moon god Sin and all that stuff, okay? Now, the context for this discussion in Cooper, when he gets into this material, is an Egyptian term that is a hapax. That is a word that occurs one time in existing Egyptian texts, and it's chenhet in Egyptian. And Cooper theorizes it's probably a Semitic loan word. It's a word that's brought into Egyptian from, you know, a Semitic language. He says in Semitic languages, the T, you know, the ch sound, the T underlined sound, corresponded to Semitic samek, which is the first letter in Sinai in Hebrew. Now he goes on to discuss this, and I'm gonna disagree with him a little bit. I'm reading you this because we have geeks in the audience who like this kind of etymological stuff. But also, if you read Cooper's material, you're going to be wondering what I think about this. So I'm going to tell you, I'm going to just read a portion here. On page 214, he says, a difficulty with this connection, that is connecting it to Sana, the bush, but I'll admit his wording in the dissertation is a little bit ambiguous here. I'm going to assume he's talking about the bush. He says, a difficulty with this connection is accounting for the final T in the Egyptian term chenhet, which must be a suffix, possibly a feminine marker. And it, typically in Egyptian, the T at the end of a noun is the marker for a feminine singular noun. And my comment to this is, why is that difficult? Sena is grammatically feminine and would have a T ending in the construct form anyway. So what's the deal? It's still the same grammatical gender. He continues, you know, with what he's saying. In ancient Levantine toponymy, again, place names in the Levant, you know, the Fertile Crescent area or, you know, Syria, Palestine. The suffix T is witnessed in toponyms, place names, but its exact morphological role is not apparent. Rainey suggests it may be a nominal or adjectival marker. Wherever Chenhet was, it was a large area comprised of multiple chasut. Now, some of you who are paying real attention to the podcast know what that term is. The hecha chasut, the rulers from foreign lands. Again, this is what the Hyksos, you know, where the term Hyksos comes from. They were Semites. So lo and behold, we have Chenhet being a large area where there's lots of Semites there. The only text where it occurs, again, Chenhet, the Egyptian term, mentions it in the context of, you know, he has a personal name there, which doesn't concern us right now. And it would seem to be in the environs of South Sinai or contiguous with Sinai. Now, this is me now. He's opining that on the basis of this personal name that he references, because the personal name he references happens to be from a text that talks about a mine in Sinai. So he's connecting these two things that don't necessarily be connected. If you have a large region where you've got Semites living, and again, you know, what's known as Sinai could extend on the basis of other texts way, 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 way up north of the Negev, all the way up to, you know, to southern Canaan, then this is a conclusion. It's a non sequitur, actually. It's a conclusion that doesn't really follow the data. But he's making these comments based on this parallel with this one Egyptian text with this proper name on it that happens to be located in the southern Sinai. Now, he writes, an equivalence with the biblical Sinai is tempting. on these grounds. But the caveat here is there's about 1,000 years separating this toponym, this place named Chenhet, from the Sinai in the oldest biblical traditions, which he has here in 1000 BC. Again, my comment here. Are we really to believe that no Semites used the term Sinai, before the Hebrew Bible was written? Like, really? The term shows up in Egyptian texts from or near mines in the Sinai Peninsula, mines which we know were worked by Semites. I mean, this is going to be part of the Semitic vocabulary before you get the Hebrew Bible written. So why it matters that the Egyptian text is older, you know, than the biblical text, I don't see why that matters at all. Again, there's a difference between a spoken language and a written language. Okay, the spoken language is going to exist before it gets codified in writing. So again, this is another conclusion that just doesn't follow in his dissertation. But since, you know, the chances are some of you are going to read this, I just thought I'd throw that in so you know what I thought. Now, my point here is that if you go out onto the internet, you know, when we're talking about the name Sinai, if you go out on the internet, you have people writing about how Sinai was really a holy mountain to the moon god Sin. You're going to see that everywhere on the internet. It's Middle Earth, okay? Know this, know two things. One, that idea isn't new. Okay, there are scholars of you know, the pan-Babylonian era especially that proposed this. And number two, there are quite coherent alternatives. So you're going to you're going to have people you run into that read this stuff, and they're going to think they've stumbled onto something, you know, like this deep dark secret of the Bible that, you know, your church, Christianity's tried to, you know, shield you from and all this nonsense, okay? You can find this in sort of antiquarian scholarship. And they'll use, again, that material, again, from the 19th century, early 20th century. But the reality is that there are quite coherent alternatives that have nothing to do with the moon god Sin, as far as the name Sinai. So let's just point that out. And that's another freebie, just kind of, you know, prepping you with that. Another thing that I've put in the folder is an article by G.I. Davies, and it is entitled The Significance of Deuteronomy 1:2 for the Location of Mount Horeb. Now, Deuteronomy 1:2 says this. Well, let's go back to verse 1. These are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel beyond the Jordan in the wilderness, in the Arabah opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, Lavan, Hazaroth, and Dizahav. It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. That's the verse that matters here. It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. Now, Davies' article I have put into the protected folder again. Some of you might want to read it. It's important, because it's one that raises important issues for thought, but I find it personally unpersuasive for a couple of reasons. And in case you read it, I want you to know what those reasons are, and you'll probably be able to figure these out on your own anyway. But the first one is that, I mean, let me just cut to the chase. Davies goes through all this data about determining, you know, where you can go from, how far you can get in 11 days, you know, from this point or that point. And he uses this to argue that the best location of Mount Sinai is the traditional site, because, you know, on average it would take, you know, and he has a number of standards for this. Like he looks at old, you know, travel records, he looks at ancient records, he looks at modern, you know, caravan, you know, records and archaeologists going from one point to the next. Basically, you can travel about 20 miles a day or something like that, you know, 2022. And he says, well, 11 days, that's going to put you, you know, up in at Kadesh Barnea, and that's like 11 days from the traditional site of Mount Sinai. So that's the best, you know, candidate for location. The other ones are too close for the 11 days. All right. So that's just in a nutshell. I disagree with that, and I'll tell you why. But the article is still important because of the things it makes you think about. So my a couple of reasons I think that this is a little wrongheaded is that it doesn't work really with the geography of the Yahweh from the South traditions. And those are important. You have to factor them in, and he doesn't, okay? His calculations of how many miles can be traveled in a day all assume, all of them, you can read the article, they all assume that the travelers are adult males, either soldiers or civilians. They don't assume large numbers of women and children and larger than normal herds. Now, I will grant And when we get to this part of Exodus, I'll explain why. I will grant that the Israelites may not have been in the millions. I don't think they were. But the nation was considerably larger than your normal caravan that Davies is doing his calculations by. His calculations do not conform to the conditions described in the Exodus itinerary. Again, I still think the point of Deuteronomy 1:2 is that it took the Israelites 11 days to go from one point to the next. Not that the 11 days allows for some calculation of mileage. I think it's a report. It took us 11 days. Moving tens of thousands of people, at a minimum, with at least half of those tens of thousands of people being women and children, along with the flocks, simply cannot be calculated by normal caravan travel. And that's what Davies is doing. To really know how far the Israelites could get in 11 days, during 11 day times, you need to assemble 30 or 40,000 people, have half of them be women and children, and then add thousands of head of goats, sheep, cattle, and et cetera, and then have a go at it. That's what you need to do. You're not getting very far, to be honest, because you're going to have to be stopping to water the flocks. You're going to have to be stopping at places. I mean, people can carry water. You're not going to be carrying water for flocks. I mean, like everybody's got, 50 pounds of water on them? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So Davies' calculations, while they might on the surface seem impressive, do not conform to the conditions that we're dealing with the Exodus travel. Secondly, he also assumes that Seir and Edom are not the same area. He's aware of some of these verses, obviously, in the article, but then he'll gravitate to places where Seir is like a different place or a neutral term that doesn't overlap with Edom. And then he'll say, see, we got to keep them separate. And then he'll talk about the ones where they're obviously together, like the March from the South passages we read. Then he'll say something like that they were put together, because of, sources. I mean, he does the source critical tango to divorce Seir and Edom from the equation that he uses. Yeah, I just don't think it's a legitimate method. Frankly, I don't think Deuteronomy 1:2 really helps us at all. I don't think it helps resolve anything, and it doesn't really help. I think that the whole point is that it took us 11 days from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir, to get to Kadesh Barnea. Again, it's not like you can make a coherent calculation from that, because we just don't have the parameters to do that. So I wanted to mention that just in case some of you read that. So we're here at the end of our episode, and we're going to come back to some of these things later when we get to the Sinai scenes of Exodus. But I wanted to, again, say some things about, especially in this episode, the need for honoring both Exodus 3 and Exodus 17 and the March from the South traditions. We need to not blunt or ignore or dismiss or dichotomize, one set of data from other, other parts of other points of data. These things need to be and can be understood together. And again, if you care to do that, and I do, and again, hopefully you understand why at this point, because those passages about the March from the South they are explicitly connected to Sinai and Midian, Exodus 3. I mean, they just are. So we have to take these things in tandem to sort of frame a picture of what's going on in Exodus 3:1 and in these other passages, where Moses is at. And I'm going to tell you right now, if you care to do that, you either have to do what Davies does and just say, oh, these don't matter. They're later, or they're the result of some, editorial snafu or whatever. We're not going to count them. You basically either cheat, or you try to, again, honor all of the data. And if you do that, I don't see how the traditional location of Mount Sinai can work. And I also don't see how Jabal al-Laws works. I think we're dealing with a different location that, frankly, my answer is, we don't know. We don't know where Mount Sinai, which mountain it was. We just don't know. And now at this point, Jabal al-Laws, there's like, burnt tops of the mountain and there's evidence for volcanic activity. So what? Why do we think we need a volcanic mountain? See, people assume that because they want a natural explanation to the fire of God's presence on Sinai. You know, frankly, if you're a theist, you don't need a natural explanation for the fiery presence of Yahweh on a mountain. You don't. But somehow, you know, this naturalistic explanation is adopted by defenders of Jebel al-Laws when they would reject it for the plagues or some other miracle or something like that. It's just at this point, it helps them make the argument for the location that they want. And what I'm here to say is I believe that's inconsistent and frankly unnecessary. And well, what about those pictographs of cattle? You know, when the Israelites, you know, when Moses was up on the mountain, you know, they made a golden calf, and boy, we've got pictures of calves, you know, Jebel al-Laws, you know, and supposedly other sacred. I mean, I've seen the pictures. I don't really see some of what I'm told I'm seeing. And again, I'm aware of all these, but you know, have those pictographs been dated? You know, there are experts. God forbid I would be one of them. You know, thank the Lord I'm not. But there are people who spend their entire lives studying rock art in Saudi Arabia and, of course, other places in the world. And there are ways to date these things. So my first question is always, well, those pictographs that you say are proof of the, you know, the events of the Exodus, and you know, this is Mount Sinai. Where's the dating analysis of them? I can tell you right now at Jebel al-Laws, again, in the promotion of this, and I used to like this theory until I realized that, really until I saw the problems that were associated with it. And as I went on, for a long time, I've not believed in the traditional site, and I liked the Jebel al-Laws site for years. But then when you really drill down into it, especially the Yahweh from the South traditions and a few other things we'll talk about when we get to these other episodes on Exodus 3, it has serious problems. Even Paul's reference in Galatians 4 to Mount Sinai in Arabia. You know, I hate to just, again, pour water on this, but there's a text critical issue there. It may not even be in the original text. Okay, I mean, there are just things like this that when you drill down, you realize how uncertain they are. And Arabia, again, is a vastly elastic term anyway in the first century period, you know, Greco-Roman, you know, understanding. There's just so many things that can go wrong. So many things that are assumed and not proven. And the pictographs is just another in a long list of these things. Where's the date for them? Can we date those things? Did you even check? You know, and please don't bring in, you know, Ron Wyatt at this point about the Egyptian chariot wheels, you know, near, you know, this or that crossing and whatnot. And frankly, you can still have, you know, a Nuweiba crossing or whatever, you know, some other kind of crossing. That really isn't the issue, because the Israelites could have kept going, you know, into the area where, you know, we're looking at. They could have crossed something at the tip of Aqaba. I mean, who cares, you know? But if you're depending on Ron Wyatt data, you're just not wise. Okay, his stuff has never been tested. It's never been pulled out for testing. We have shapes of things that may or may not be Egyptian chariot wheels. And I also hope you realize that Egyptian chariot wheels, the design of them, differed in different eras. Okay, and there ought to be hundreds of them, not just two or three. And they're probably not chariot wheels to begin with, but again, I digress. You know, again, if you really want to prove it, pull one out and have it dated, have it tested, have it analyzed. But Wyatt and others just simply don't do this stuff. Or they'll claim to have found something that's now disappeared. You know, the dog ate my, you know, inscription. The dog ate this, the dog ate that. The Saudis took it, the Saudis stole it. Well, that's convenient. Again, you've got to do better than that. I mean, especially as Christians. As Christians, if we want to do this kind of research, especially if there's an apologetic bent to it for some reason or along some trajectory, you just have to be more honest than this. You just have to be. Because if it's easily underminable by very simple, straightforward, frankly, very obvious questions. Hey, do we have a date for that? That specimen thing? Do we actually have it here? Okay, we can look at. You know, if it's always no and it's missing, the arguments are no better than the kind of stuff that you get with ancient aliens talk. Now that might sound harsh, but honestly, that's where it's at. I meet people all the time, you know, through email mostly, that, you know, will show me things where people belittle faith in Christianity because of poor scholarship and the poor reasoning that Christians do in areas like this. And yeah, I'll grant you that the atheists, they do a lot of poor reasoning too. We have a lot of poor scholarship too. But my point is that we shouldn't. So I'm hoping, again, that you see the complexity of something as simple as Exodus 3:1. And now you may have a new thing to factor in. The Yahweh from the South traditions. Again, these are all important. They are all in Scripture. They are all pertinent to the same events, the same, you know, issue as far as, you know, Yahweh and the knowledge of Yahweh in a given geographical part. They're all important. Again, we need to honor all of the data and struggle with it. And that's what Bible study is about. That's what Bible study is about. It's not about looking for quick answers and proof texts. Again, if that's what you want, you're not really doing Bible study. You're doing something else, and it could turn around and bite you in the theological butt, or it could, you know, have a worse effect when, again, people aren't willing to listen to you about something that really is important, like the gospel, but you have not gained a hearing with them because of poor research in some other area. Now, that's a shame. It's a shame that those two things get married in the minds of some people, but they do. So we need to, again, be a little more circumspect about this. And as the next episodes we have on Exodus 3, parts 2 and 3, again, we'll get down into some more of these details and then even more. Again, we're not done with Sinai once we get out of Exodus 3, trust me. Some of these other issues, some of the things we talked about even today will come back into our discussion. But again, I'm hoping that you see the complexity, but also, again, get an appreciation for, you know, what's a distraction and what's not, and the need, again, to do good research.
Mike, you're either raining on people's parades or blowing their minds.
Or enraging the masses.
But it's okay. Hey, you don't need to know. You know, it's okay to not know. You know,
It is. There's like I said at the beginning of the episode, there's no crucial issue of theology here.
Yeah.
There just isn't. But when we get people that, is, you know, sometimes they want to pin some important issue of theology to something like this, it's just a mistake. It's just unnecessary.
All right. Well, we're giving people permission to let it go. So there you go.
Either that or permission to mail me a pitchfork and a torch.
Yeah, please email Mike and not Trey, please. Not me. But all right, Mike. Well, we're going to get into part two next week. I'm looking forward to getting into how you're going to connect that to the Watchers. So that's going to be entertaining. And with that, Mike, all right. I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.